Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:08 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is June 19th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. What I thought we'd kick off with and think about this week would be more to do with high conviction ideas and low conviction ideas, because we've been through an incredibly uncertain period, and arguably it's not over. So that's something that I think everybody is dealing with right now. Then there are obviously things that we do not know the answer to, and it's impossible to know the answer to yet. There are others that are quite likely outcomes. And then thinking about what are the likely outcomes versus the things that we don't know, I think will probably put us in a better position to come up with a framework about how to actually deal with the market as it evolves over the coming months and years. So I thought thinking about healthcare is an easy one to start off with. Just the broad healthcare index has been rising for a decade. It certainly pulled back. It then rebounded quite quickly. It is firming from the region of the trend mean. This is what I would term to be an easy chart to analyze. It's very simple. Provided it continues to hold this bounce, we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. When we then think about some of the growth sectors within the healthcare sector, like the NASDAQ Biotech Index, it was up in dynamic fashion in here this week. We've had a little consolidation in the region of the peak from 2015 over the course of the last month. This is an emphatic breakout, and it does suggest that there is ample scope for additional upside. Well, I think when we think about, well, what is it that we can be certain of? What are the things that we're uncertain about? It's a pretty strong conviction that the pace with which the coronavirus had its DNA sequenced, the speed with which the over 100 potential candidates for a vaccine have been brought to some form of phase trials, and the potential that we're going to have a vaccine active in production and reaching people within the next few months is incredible for the entire sector, because it's not just about the ability to get this done, but it is a proof of concept that not only is genetics a game changer for the sector, but that it can come through with solutions in such a short time frame that it raises significant questions about the trials process. And if it can be proven that these vaccines that are being produced can in fact be brought to market with no ill effects, then we're talking about a massive innovation that is likely to save millions of lives and can do so at a much reduced cost, much reduced time frame, much greater efficiency. And that's an absolute game changer for the healthcare sector, because it is going to open up whole ranges of additional potential treatments. When we think about the potential for genetic solutions, we already have trial results that came out this week. And one of the companies that were engaged in these trial results was Vertex Pharmaceuticals. And they have quite likely now got a cure for sickle cell disease and also thalassemia. Now, those are chronic they're genetic diseases, and they affect anything up to 1 in 2,500 people. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot when we think about the incidence of heart disease or cancer, for example. Unfortunately, when you start to multiply up the numbers and you look at total population, then you're talking about a large number of people. Cystic fibrosis would be another one of those types of diseases that affects a substantial number of people. There is no real treatment that could amount to a cure for it, and people who have the disease tend to die young. Well, there's the real potential that these types of genetic diseases will no longer exist in a decade as a result of the innovation that's happening in terms of genetics. It greatly enhances the potential that we're also going to see the chronic conditions that are massive cost centers for national health services also be addressed in the form of treatments from a genetic perspective for diabetes, for arthritis, and potentially also for Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. Now, those are massive cost centers. One of the things that is well accepted in the markets is that every $10 move in the price of oil is generally coincident with a 0.2% rise or fall in GDP. Well, we've had some very significant moves in oil prices, but one thing that is much less discussed is the impact that healthcare has on GDP, because costs are ramping up and the range of potential ailments that are untreatable and that are chronic in nature and cost a fortune to treat but not to cure is only growing as people live longer. And that is a subject that gets very little, I think, coverage in terms of how much it costs and how much of a burden it is on the overall economy. Well, the very potential that we're seeing these healthcare sectors breaking on the upside, on the back of everything that's happened as a result of the coronavirus, is a clear indication that this could be, in fact, a best-case solution, that we're going to see a very significant change in the makeup of the economy over the course of the next decade and longer. And that is really very bullish. So when we think about where are high conviction ideas, that is certainly something that I think is going to very likely be an outcome that we can bank on when we think about what is likely over the course of the next decade. Then let's think about over the course of the next decade in oil prices. Well, we have seen a very significant decline going from $80 to $20 in the space of 18 months is an incredible decline for a globally significant commodity. Now, we have had a meaningful rebound up 100% in the space of 3 months is a significant move, and it's not over. We're continuing to see additional strength coming through in the oil price, although it was pretty much unchanged in here today. The reality is that it is still a vital commodity for the global community, and that is likely to continue to be the case for the foreseeable future. Nonetheless, we are seeing a great deal of additional interest being put into battery technology and also into hydrogen fuel cells. Natural gas prices are rock bottom right now. They are starting to firm from around the 160 area. When we look at the much longer term chart, we can see that it is one of the few commodities that completely gave up all of the advance put in during the big commodity bull market from the early 2000s onwards, and prices today are approximating where the lows were all the way back from 1995 through to approximately 1999. When the price of a vital commodity drops like this, then not only do you get the clear determination of consumers to use more of it, to substitute whatever costs more for using more of this That is certainly starting to come through in terms of the evolution of the hydrogen fuel cell market, which is still in its infancy but growing quickly on the back of very low natural gas prices. But at the same time, you also had a rule in here this week where the flaring of gas and the time that producers of oil in Texas would be allowed to flare gas was halved in here this week. So that is also a response to the environment, that there is this environmental lobby that is becoming increasingly vocal, increasingly more powerful, and that it is having a knock-on effect. But also, when prices are this low, you do get supply destruction also coming through, and that is equally true of oil. There are going to be significant sources of oil locked in as long as prices are ranging around $40. There's a lot of oil. It becomes economic at $80. There is even more becomes economic at $100. But all of this is pointing towards a secular market where there is ample supply. And that is likely to remain the case. Low energy prices are a facilitator in terms of the production of industrial resources. Well, another high conviction idea has to be that we're going to have an infrastructure boom. Somebody sent me a report, and I'm going to find it. I thought it was rather interesting because it is basically telling us everything that China has done in terms of their infrastructure. They've built railroads, dams, ports, bridges, aircrafts, and they're moving into space. They've got a massive railroad system. They've built an incredible road network. They've built massive hydro dams, and there have obviously been massive investments in their port facilities, not just at home but internationally. These are, I think, very significant factors that China has done massive infrastructure development already. And therefore, we have to conclude that if China is going to engage in more of this infrastructure development, well, the chances are that it's not going to be the same kind of infrastructure that they built. They may build high-tension power lines. They might build more electricity generating capacity to provide more batteries. The one thing that China certainly does not have enough of is oil and gas, and or indeed for that matter, coking coal. So they are probably the country most interested in becoming energy independent. That is one of the necessary conditions to become the global hegemon, and they certainly want to achieve that goal. But China is not energy independent, and it is a long way from being energy independent. If we were to think about what kind of infrastructure China needs to build, well, then it's going to have to be in some way or form renewable or not dependent on fossil fuels. That pretty much points towards uranium, or it looks towards solar, wind, and potential, and I think there is just no way they're going to get it done without the scope for much greater investment in uranium and nuclear facilities. The uranium price has pulled back in here this week, but it has broken up and out of the base put in between 2016 and 2020. Now the question is whether it can hold the breakout. So there is certainly the potential there. But one thing that is worth considering is that China was the major infrastructure developer over the course of the last 15 years. They've already built a lot. And if they continue at that pace, they're really just going to be building more ghost cities and more roads to nowhere. China already has a very significant road network. they're probably going to build more high-speed rail because it's impossible for China to approach the kind of car ownership that the USA has, or indeed Europe has. They simply have too many people and the country is not big enough. And that means that more high-speed rail is very likely to be built in China. So I think that also falls into the high conviction category. India absolutely needs infrastructure. There is absolutely no getting around that. They have got a population of 1.3 billion people, and half of them are younger than 25 years old. They need jobs. There will be massive social unrest in India without jobs for those hundreds of millions of young people. And that means that there's going to have to be manufacturing. There is going to have to be a lot more investment in producing and building up the domestic economy. India has done a lot of the easier things, the things that do not require a lot of infrastructure. They've invested in a 4G network. So that has afforded everybody the potential to have an online bank account, access to online entertainment, to have a smartphone in their pockets. Reliance Industries continues to benefit enormously from that and by selling off part of their network to big companies like Amazon and Facebook, they have now been able to go net debt free. So that's incredible, considering that the share had already been up meaningfully over the course of the last 3 years and has more than doubled off the lows set in March. There is the very strong likelihood that India is going to build the infrastructure it needs, that it is going to encourage manufacturing into the country. Quite whether it is going to be Chinese companies investing in India to build their factories is another story entirely when we start thinking about the territorial ambitions of China and the clear willingness of India to stand up and defend their borders and to continue to be more assertive on the global stage. There is the obvious potential that India, as it rises and becomes more powerful and more assertive and becomes a manufacturing power in its own right, will be more assertive towards China. And not least, that India sits on the trade route from the Middle East to China. China obviously wants to secure its supply chain. That's why they've been building ports in a daisy chain. Right along the route from China to the Middle East for the oil. But obviously, India sitting right in the middle of that represents a geopolitical risk for China. That isn't something that is about to go away, and India has a long coastline. Well, obviously, that represents a challenge and an uncertainty, that geopolitical tensions are something that represent a significant uncertainty for the globe and for the foreseeable future. They represent both a high conviction and a low conviction element because we can be certain that it's going to be a problem. It's going to be a challenge. It's also going to create buying opportunities during periods of uncertainty. But the uncertainty, of course, is that we don't know how bad it's going to get. The Nifty index in India was positive in here today, and the Indian rupee was also steadier. We continue to see that it is rebounding and unwinding the oversold condition relative to the trend mean. The one certainty we have is that India's growth is likely to significantly outpace that of both Europe and the USA for the foreseeable future, and that should act as a backstop to the stock market generally. Now, when we think about one of the big uncertainties, it's about liquidity. There has been a massive amount of money poured into the market over the course of the last 3 months. The size of the Federal Reserve's balance sheet has expanded by 3 trillion so far, but it did contract over the course of the last week. And that's not exactly in the playbook. The recent strength of the US dollar following a significant decline has also weighed on the total assets of central banks chart, and that has also contracted over the course of the last few weeks. So when we then think about what's going on Wall Street, well, the S&P 500 has had three relatively equal sized reactions, and we're in the third of those, but at least this is above the trend mean. I was really quite eager to point out the improved valuations and some very deep oversold conditions back in March. I became a lot more leery of the market as it came back up to test the region of the trend mean in May. By and large, following a very significant pullback like that, we would anticipate that you do get a pullback towards the lows, or that you get a retest of the lows. And on this occasion, we haven't. It hasn't really been a very significant decline. I think the very short consolidation we had for only 3 days in the first 3 days of April doesn't really qualify. But the reality is that we're back in the region of the peak. There hasn't been a meaningful consolidation. Now, that's an uncertainty because generally corrective phases move in a reasonably predictable manner. You get a very sharp pullback, you get a reversionary rally. Usually that reversionary rally rolls over, and then that provides another buying opportunity before support starts to come through and you get higher levels. On this occasion, the market has just gone straight back up. And now we're in the region of the peak. So the big question, and it is an uncertainty, is do we now get the pullback that would have been expected earlier, or do we simply skip that and go straight on to a recovery scenario? Well, I was willing to bet that we were going to get a pullback last week, and then I was quickly stopped out of my short position. And since then, the NASDAQ has gone right back up to test the peak and to exceed the 10,000 level once more. For a very brief period today, it looked almost like we were going to get a downside key reversal today. It did not form. The market did rally back above that 10,000 level by the close. And so far, the sequence of higher reaction lows off the nadir in March has continued to hold. 9,500 points is now a significant area of short-term support. And we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside as long as it is holding that level. In the event that the breakout fails, then depending on the size of the dynamic, it would greatly enhance the scope that we come back and test the region of the trend mean or potentially even the lows in March. So that is what the potential outcome could be from a failure at these levels. But a sustained breakout from here would reassert the medium-term uptrend, and we know that it is liquidity-fueled. Now, I do really regard the kind of assistance that the Federal Reserve is offering as an inverse of what people used to think of as the uptick rule. The uptick rule meant that you could not initiate a new short position without the price rising first. Well, it was dispensed with, and now that's only implemented when circuit breakers have been broken. But if you think about it the other way around, the Federal Reserve is, and central banks generally, are really only willing to announce new stimulative measures after a decline in the stock market. So that's exactly what we had earlier this week. On Monday, after two significant days on the downside where the NASDAQ 100 fell by about 5%, well, then we had two announcements. The first was that the Federal Reserve was going to buy individual bonds as well as to buy the bonds or the corporate bond ETFs. They also announced that they were going to ramp up the Main Street lending program. Now, one thing that I think is important to highlight here is we've had a very significant rally in high yield already. And going from under 70 to 85 in the space of just a few weeks is a really very significant move. And now we're seeing some reticence to continue to pay up for high yield bonds. We're also, I think we can think about the investment grade bonds, that they also did particularly well following that announcement by the Federal Reserve, but they have not been able to do better than that because the Federal Reserve has said they're going to buy the bonds, and how many of those bonds they'll buy will be dependent on how bad the economy gets. But the economy is not getting worse at the moment, therefore they're not buying the bonds. We've seen from their balance sheet that they're not expanding the size of the balance sheet. In other words, it looks increasingly likely that the Federal Reserve is in fact waiting for evidence of a weaker economic expansion before deploying additional resources. Now, I have no doubt that they will continue to expend resources, that they will have a clear willingness to expand the balance sheet, to buy assets, to inflate the prices of securities, but that it's not going to happen in a straight line. And that, I think, is one of the big takeaways from what we've seen in here this week. This big question that is being asked first by very sober-minded institutional value investors who are pointing out that this looks like a bubble. The strong likelihood is they are correct, that this is a bubble. But in much the same fashion as in the late 1990s, calling out the bubble and the peak of the market is not the same thing. I do think that what we see today is very similar to what we had with Y2K. In the late 1990s, everyone believed that when the dates ticked over to the 1st of January 2000, that computer systems wouldn't be able to handle it, that there was a massive push to upgrade, there was a huge investment in infrastructure. And by the time we got around to the 1st of January 2000, all of the sales from that whole year and beyond had been pulled into 1999. The valuations were extraordinary, and interest rates had already started to rise, and it killed the bull market. Well, the Federal Reserve is not raising interest rates. So I think that's certainly something that is off the table right now. And in fact, the 10-year yield is back below 70 basis points. There is certainly a very, very mild upward bias to the yield over the course of the last 3 months, but the clear potential is that we're going to see additional downside. When we look at the 30-year yield, I think it is the most important one to monitor in terms of the consistency of the trend. If we see the 30-year yield pushing above 2%, that would be confirmation that we're moving into an inflationary environment. And personally, I think it is likely that the massive monetary accommodation that we're seeing globally is eventually going to climax in inflation. However, in the short term, the risk is deflation. And that is what's being priced into markets now. That is why central banks are so eager to continue to support markets. They're so eager to continue to print and to coordinate with governments to fund massive deficits. And when we think about the corollaries with Y2K, we also know that the actions of retail investors was certainly one of the things that helped to really stoke investor interest in the 1990s. Certainly, I remember going to visit private banks in Luxembourg in the very early 2000s, and they had a large number of very young new associates that had all been hired to talk to clients and put them into IPOs. And a lot of those young guys were left go in the subsequent bear market, and demand for IPO trading evaporated. Well, now we're looking at the very real potential that the challenges that some of the FANG stocks have arrayed against them are being underplayed by the market, because in the short term they are doing better. On the one hand, you have Apple, which has had to close stores, and it was at a new high in here today, and it wasn't quite able to hold it, but certainly nothing in the way of a dynamic move. Down $2 on a $350 share is not a significant move, but we are overbought in the short term. Now, they are not able to open many of their stores. They've had to close some because of rising coronavirus cases. And the bigger question is, when is their new phone going to come out? When is their new 5G handset going to start to be sold? And obviously that is where the growth is coming from, but it's not on the market yet, and the potential for sales from it are being priced in already. Then we have the clear intention of the EU to try and tax companies like Google and Facebook. Well, Google's share got back up to test the peak, and it was also in mildly negative territory in here today. Now, the question that some of these companies are going to have to deal with is that they have got these massive cash piles, and they are not investing them domestically, and they don't really have a lot of physical infrastructure that they require for their businesses other than data centers. Facebook has broken on the upside, and I think certainly if we look at the difficulties the company experienced after 2016 and the success that they have had in avoiding outright regulation by self-flagellating is really very impressive. And as we head into what is likely to be an even more divisive presidential cycle, then Facebook's ability to continue to do well from here is really a true testament to the strength of their management. Microsoft and the fact that they migrated onto a subscription business model has continued to support the price. The share has been consolidating in the region of the peak. It pulled back for 4 days and subsequently held the sequence of higher reaction lows. It briefly hit a new high in here today, but there is obviously the potential that it's going to stick out as another target for the EU to look at in terms of taxation. Adobe has surged on to new high ground, and this has been one of the companies that implemented a subscription business model first. Their number one business is tailoring photos, and when you sell anything online, what you are in fact selling is a photo rather than a product. Products might be delivered, but what you're selling is a photo, and you need Adobe if you're going to sell online, or at least the people that are doing your photos for you need it. And the subscription business model has been able to flatten out their growth curve, and it is another incredible technology success story that is at a new all-time high. Well, nothing has really happened to question the ability of these types of companies to continue to do better, while there are still risks out there. So short term, they do look still to be in fine fettle. And then the potential risks from overburden of regulatory scrutiny is something that could have a longer term effect, but not necessarily in the short term. Now let's think about, where are we in terms of combating the coronavirus? Because it does represent the major uncertainty that everyone is worried about today. One thing that we certainly have now that we did not have in February is more information. So the kinds of things we know are that it is most easily spread in indoor, highly concentrated or population dense areas, that it is less easily spread outdoors, that the mortality rate is not 4%. It is more like 0.2 to 0.3%, which is a multiple or perhaps two multiples as fatal as the seasonal flu. The one challenge that we certainly have an appreciation for today with the coronavirus is how transmissible it is. And it is the speed of transmission is the primary challenge. But because it is not nearly as fatal as had been feared in February, then there is the clear scope for less onerous lockdowns and for economies to open back up in a more robust fashion. The challenge with doing that is that consumer confidence has been so clearly damaged, and the dangers have been so effectively rammed into people's minds that it is likely to have a deleterious effect on sentiment as long as case numbers continue to rise. I mean, personally, I went to the gym 3 times early this week. I decided not to go yesterday or today because of the rising number of cases in Los Angeles. And I think that is a decision that lots of people will make about where they go shopping, how they spend their money, what they spend their time on. It means that even though we have the scope to, in fact, loosen lockdowns, and governments are increasingly going to adopt that will probably help manufacturing activity. It will probably help a number of different sections of the economy to get back to work, but it is likely to have an onerous effect on consumer sentiment. And I think that's one of the more uncertain outcomes. The potential for continued monetary stimulus is heavily dependent on the impact that the perception of risk regarding the coronavirus has on consumer sentiment. So when we think about the domestic economies, well, I think it is worth looking at the fact that the small caps have not bounced back above their trend means. In fact, it is looking potentially like encountering resistance in the region of the trend mean over the last 4 days. The size of the reactions since March have been relatively similar, although this one is mildly larger. So certainly the low around 1350 needs to hold if this is going to remain a consistent rebound. The recent weakness that we've seen in the banking sector is also a bit of a standout. Banks are not going to make a lot of money when the central bank looks to be very clearly targeting the yield curve. And this yield curve targeting has been a significant factor in Japan, despite the fact the Federal Reserve has really not been talking about yield curve control. it does look like they are practicing it and are hitting down yields when they get up to about 70 basis points. Historically, it has been when the yield curve surges through 50 basis points following an inversion that the stock market tends to get a real fright. And yield curve control is at least an attempt to stop that from happening. So I think that is one of the instructive points. But the other thing, of course, is that if we're going to think about how to get out of the slump caused by the coronavirus, well, then infrastructure is one of the big answers. And President Trump is talking about a $1 trillion infrastructure project. The UK is talking about an infrastructure project. Infrastructure is also likely to figure in any kind of recovery in Europe. That's going to be beneficial for commodity producers like Australia or Brazil or South Africa or Canada. And it might have been China that was the infrastructure builder of the last decade. There is the potential that it is going to be the rest of the world becomes the massive infrastructure builder of this decade. I think that is a very likely scenario when we look at the impact and the challenge that the contraction in economic activity represented by the lockdowns has had on just about everything. So when we think about what are the uncertainties and what are the things that we can be certain of, its liquidity is likely, and the impact on sentiment from the coronavirus is unknowable, but it is likely to take time to recover from. The outlook for infrastructure is positive. The outlook for the healthcare sector is positive. Eventually, it is quite likely we're going to have an inflationary outcome. And the reality is that with massive deficits, with huge run-ups in the size of central bank balance sheets, then the clear potential is that they're going to keep doing that until they get inflation. Then the question will be, what can they do to stop it? Because the velocity of money is on the floor, and the quantity of money that has been created is literally infinite without causing an inflationary outcome as long as the velocity of money stops. But when you get economic recovery, that's when the liquidity needs to be withdrawn from the system. Now, at that point, either we're going to get an inflationary outcome because they don't raise interest rates and withdraw the liquidity quick enough, or we get a significant contraction because they do withdraw the liquidity. I think it is much more likely that we get the inflationary outcome. There's going to be a very clear determination by the world's central banks to inflate their way out of trouble. And that is, I think, the primary reason why gold is rallying. I think it's also particularly relevant that gold has been rallying now for just about a year and 8 months. So not quite 2 years yet. It's also pausing below the $1,800 level, and $1,800 was a meaningful area of resistance in 2011 and 2012. So it's logical that we might have some consolidation in this area. I do think that what's happening with the gold-silver ratio is particularly noteworthy, because if we go back and look at history, we can clearly see that silver is high beta gold, but that it does tend to act with a significant lag at the beginning of bull markets. That was certainly the case in the early 2000s. Gold pretty much bottomed in 2000 and 2001. And silver didn't start to outperform gold until well into 2003, so about 2 years later. Then silver peaked relative to gold in 2006 and underperformed for 2 years ahead of the real crisis in 2008. Then it bottomed in 2008 and went on a tear versus gold, where silver went up twice as fast as gold into the peak in 2011. And subsequent to that, it has been underperforming for the last 8 years. Now, it hit a very significant low versus gold, where gold traded at 120 times the price of silver for a brief period in February, and subsequently we have seen it come back to about 100. Now, if we look at the fact that on occasion gold's outperformance, at least twice in the last 20 years, has ended about 2 years later, or that silver tends to pick up the baton for outperformance about 2 years after gold starts to rally. Well, it hasn't quite been 2 years yet, but silver is definitely basing. It has been ranging below $20 for the last 6 years, and that is a very significant failed downside break below 15 in February. So it is steadying, and it was back up towards the $18 level in here today. It hasn't quite yet been able to push up and out of this range that's been forming for the last month, but a sustained move back above the $20 area would confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment for silver, and not just beyond the short, or not just for the short term, but potentially a new medium-term bull market environment, which would increase the scope that the peak around $50 will be exceeded during that bull market. Now, that's a, I would say, falls into the pretty high conviction category, because the likelihood is that central banks are going to continue to pursue inflation until they get it. And it's at that point that the bull market in bonds will likely end. Now, I think people are starting to come around to that idea that the asset class, and I think there is debate about the asset class that does best in an inflationary outcome. Is it going to be precious metals, or is it going to be property, or selected stocks, or dividend-paying stocks, or growth stocks? But there is very little debate about the sector that does worst, and that is long-dated bonds. So that is why it is worth keeping an eye on the 30-year yield, because when it eventually breaks its downtrend, then we are in a bear market for debt, and it's likely to be an inflationary problem. Well, if one is then looking at hedges and a hedge against what the risk is in the fixed income market, then rather than holding bonds as part of a portfolio, it may make more sense to hold gold as the hedge against equity. And if that idea gains traction, well, then there is the potential that we see significant additional upside in the precious metal sector. The one thing we certainly know is that mine production has been steady, and that gold miners are not investing in new mines. They are much more interested in buying each other out or merging on an equal parity basis. But they're not spending a ton of money on additional investment in greenfield sites. And the gold miners ETF looks like it is putting in a first step above the 7-year base formation. So this is a very high conviction looking chart. The completion of a base formation is about the most reliable continuation pattern outside of a consistent trend that one might wish for. And the clear takeaway is that These are not stocks that are trading at their all-time highs. They are not reliant on the momentum move, but rather that they are just completing a base formation. So we're at the beginning of a bull market rather than coming towards the end. And I think that's one of the other big points, that when you're looking at something that has been rallying for 10 years already and it's breaking out to new high ground, well, you can support that bull market. You can look at it as a momentum move, but it's not value. That's, I think, the clear conclusion. And that if you are looking for value, well, usually something that represents value is cheaper, and it's a lot closer to its lows than it is to its peaks. Well, gold shares certainly fit into that bracket. But we are starting to get, I think, differentiation between sectors that are doing well and sectors that aren't. I think Berkshire Hathaway is a really good example of that. The share did really fantastically well between about 2011 and through to the peaks in 2018. Then it went sideways, popped on the upside right at the beginning of this year. Now, that could have been the resumption of the overall bull market. It wasn't the first time that the price had gone through a two-year consolidation. The last time had been 2015 and 2016, but then it failed. And it failed in pretty dynamic fashion, and then it got up to the trend mean and failed again. So this is a type two top. We have the loss of momentum, we have the failed upside break, massive reaction against the prevailing trend, period of right-hand extension. Well, when we then think about this very large downside weekly Q reversal we had last week, the failure to rally meaningfully this week, this is not a bullish chart. It is a clear suggestion that if the price is going to rally from here, if it is going to be able to repair the damage done to the trend, it's going to be a lengthy process. So we have companies that are doing very well, that are breaking on the upside, and there's a comparatively small number of those. We have some sectors that are just beginning to break out of their base formations, and there is a comparatively small number of those as well. Newmont Mining, for example, is the only one of the gold shares that is listed on the S&P 500. In other words, the sector doesn't really move the needle for institutional investors when the quantities of money changing hands is in the hundreds of billions. Then gold shares are still a really small sector. We then have the fact that there are a lot of companies that are right in the middle, that they are doing reasonably well, but that they have got the very significant headwind from the economy, and there is a lot of debt. And I think Boeing is a good example of a share that has been the victim of financialization. There are a large number of companies that have hollowed out their balance sheets by buying back their own shares, and they have become less resilient to shocks. And that is perhaps another high conviction way of thinking about the market, that we are likely to have a much greater corporate focus on resiliency, that the share buybacks are likely to be a less significant factor going forward, that the globalization trend has already peaked and could have potentially peaked as much as a decade ago. That was probably when globalization was firing on all cylinders. Now we're likely to see much more concentration on nearshoring, on ensuring that there is more than one supplier, on looking at what are the healthcare, geopolitical, transportation risks for all global supply chains. And that is going to represent a significant migration out of China into other countries, some brought home, some not. But resiliency is going to become a more significant factor. That also means that there will be less shares bought back. There will be more retained earnings. Well, if companies are retaining earnings, they're not paying them out as dividends. These are potentially significant issues from the perspective of longer-term investors. And obviously, there are going to be clear losers from this kind of environment. And I think that Boeing is a poster child for that kind of new transition. It's a company that had no buffer to the fact that its planes, in the first instance, were falling out of the sky, and subsequently that demand evaporated. It is the kind of company that could range for a prolonged period. When we think about the airline sector, some will definitely do better than others. Delta Airlines, for example, has rebounded, and it is likely to survive. United Airlines has also another company that has very little buffer. But these are the kinds of shares that could potentially have Type 3 bottoms. And they could range for prolonged periods because of the lack of resiliency that they have and less tolerance by investors for the kind of financialization that they've engaged in. It means that we're getting something, I think, akin to an all change in the way that investors treat the market, because institutions now are much more cautious. They are demanding more resiliency in business plans, despite the fact that the Federal Reserve and central banks all over the world are flooding the market with liquidity and certainly helping to depress borrowing costs. The shock value of the coronavirus is likely to have an impact on corporate boardrooms for the foreseeable future. But at the other side of that, because yields are so low, then the willingness of venture capitalists to go further out the risk curve, to look at highly speculative ventures as potential for dividend improvement and for higher returns, that is likely to remain the case. It is one of the potential tailwinds that we're going to have from the market because of this very low and liquid overall environment. And from that perspective, I think that the continued ability of a company like Tesla to hold its uptrend is going to be one of the most important to monitor, because to the extent that it is a car company, it is also a battery company, and it wouldn't be able to turn a profit without its ability to game the system through regulatory arbitrage. So in many respects, Tesla is a regulatory arbitrage company, and it is a lightning rod for speculative flows as liquidity increases. So therefore, it is likely to be one of the canaries in the coal mine for the willingness to support highly speculative ventures. In many respects, I think Netflix is in a similar boat. It's a company that is a long way from making a profit, yet it has been able to hold this break above the 400 point level or dollar level in really very robust fashion. Then I think the other that everyone seems to be extremely excited about is Shopify, and the share has been able to push on to new high ground. Now, the important point here is that this is a company that has an estimated PE of 1,700. Now, they may be the real or the only potential head-on competitor for Amazon. And Amazon is now above the $2,500 area, and it was again up by about 1% in here today. But the kinds of moves that we're having are bubblish. It is likely that the value investors who are stepping to the side today, and Jeremy Grantham being a good example of those, saying that he's going to leave the bubble to retail investors. And UBS quoted this week saying to institutional investors to leave the bubble to the retail investors. The prognostications of Howard Marks and Stanley Druckenmiller and David Tepper saying that this does look bubbly. And there is no question to that. These shares do look bubbly. But until we start to see the flow of liquidity really contract or interest rates rise, then there is the scope that this bubble will continue. And that what we are in fact looking at is the real third stage of the psychological or the third psychological perception stage of the bull market, which is a mania, and that the turning up of retail investors over the last 9 months is a symptom of that. The willingness to continue to support highly speculative ventures is a symptom of that. Then we have the financial innovation of ETFs, which is essentially an embedded momentum strategy because of the market cap weightings that we have for most indices. But the proliferation of ETFs has been the defining financial innovation of the last decade, and it is an earnings agnostic strategy. So, earnings agnostic investing is something that appears in the latter stages of every bull market. The fact that we are now almost li entirely liquidity fueled is further evidence that we are in a mania. And the thing about manias is that they can go on for longer than many people thought possible. And the fact that we are seeing so many speculative shares moving on the upside to new all-time highs, well, that is supportive of the view that we are now in the mania phase of this bull market. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I wish all the best to all of you.